Hello and welcome to a new episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. Today we will be talking with Professor Tina Parohit about her new book, The Aga Khan Case, Religion and Identity in Colonial India. Dr. Tina Parohit is an assistant professor of religion at Boston University. Her book, The Aga Khan Case, Religion and Identity in Colonial India, was published by Harvard University Press in 2012. This book is a wonderfully written and carefully researched work that straddles multiple fields and disciplinary approaches. The central theme that animates this book is that of how colonial power, both discursive and institutional, transforms the normative boundaries and horizons of religious identities. More specifically, the Aga Khan case examines the transformation of Khoja Ismaili identity in colonial India. The title of this book refers to a case in 1866 lodged by the Khojas of Bombay against the then Aga Khan over the ownership and control of their property. However, this ostensible property dispute spiraled into a much larger debate over religion and religious identity. Through a dazzling analysis of novel historical and textual archives, Professor Parohit demonstrates that the Aga Khan case of 1866 indelibly transformed the nature and boundaries of Ismaili religious identity in South Asia, often in ways that remain highly relevant even today. In our conversation, we discussed the major themes and arguments of the book. We also talked about the broader theoretical and conceptual interventions of this book in the fields of religion, Islamic studies, and South Asian studies. Here now is my conversation with Professor Tina Parohit. Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today, we will be talking with Professor Tina Parohit, who is a professor of Islamic Studies and Religious Studies at Boston University, and her new book called The Aga Khan Case, Religion and Identity in Colonial India, published by Harvard University Press in 2012. Hello, Tina. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you, Sher Ali. Thank you for inviting me here to New Books in Islamic Studies.
No, thank you so much for being here with us and for giving us your time. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of this very fascinating and well-documented and carefully historicized project about Khoja Ismaili identity in colonial India, let me begin by asking you and providing our listeners some sense of your own biography as an author and scholar of Islam and religion. So if I would ask you, how did you come to the study of religion and Islam? If you could tell our listeners some kind of a background about how you became interested in the study of religion and the story behind the writing of this book.
Sure. I came to the study of religion and the study of Islam in a somewhat circuitous path. I began as an undergraduate studying classics. So I came to the study of religion actually via philology and classics. Mm-hmm. I studied Greek and Latin and Sanskrit as an undergraduate. And then at the master's level and PhD stage, I continued with Sanskrit, but also started taking Hindi, Urdu, and also Gujarati. So I came to the study of Islam first via the study of Indian medieval vernacular devotional literature. And specifically interest in Bhakti poets who were influenced by Sufism, more specifically. Mm-hmm. So I started reading a lot of Kabir and Nanak, and it was at this point that I discovered the Ginans, these poems that are really the subject of this book, which are a body of poems composed in the early modern medieval period in many languages of Western India, Hindi, Urdu, Gujarati, but also Sindhi and Kutchi. And these poems became the topic of my dissertation research eventually. So that was the literary and religious studies side. But as a PhD student, I was also introduced to South Asian history. I started taking classes in South Asian history and got interested in debates on historiography and especially the place of Islam in South Asia. So I really came to the study of Islam via South Asian history as well as Indian devotional literature, I would say.
Wonderful, wonderful. And clearly, when one reads the book, one can see that you straddle many different disciplines and many different textual and historical archives in very adept ways, and that provides our listeners with a good sense of the background of how you were able to do that. So before we do the specific details of the book, perhaps we can begin by my asking you about some basic terminology which might be helpful for listeners of this program. Your book is entitled The Aga Khan Case. So perhaps you could give us some kind of a background about who is the Aga Khan and who are the Khojas that you specifically write about. How are they related? And what is this case that you that forms the title of your book? So perhaps some kind of a background on these key terminologies that are central to your projects.
Sure. And this is kind of, this is the real history, the background of the history here. I'll be happy to share that with you. So the book focuses primarily on the story of the 19th century Khoja community of Bombay and their conflicts with the Aga Khan. So let me start with the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan was a Persian nobleman who was attached to the Qajar court of Persia, you know, the dynasty that came into the power in the late 18th century. And in the beginning of the early 19th century, the Qajar court was ruled by an absolute monarch called Fateh Ali Shah, who appointed the Aga Khan as governor of two provinces, Mahalat and Qom. And at the same time, the Aga Khan was married to the daughter of Fateh Ali Khan. So there was a family alliance that augmented this, these political ties to the Qajar court. So he had a very good relationship with Fateh Ali Shah, but when his successor came to power, his name is Muhammad Shah, for some reason, and this is not entirely clear in the history so far, the Aga Khan declared a series of rebellions against the Qajar government. And he gathered his own troops, and he started to instigate these rebellions, these uprisings in 1837 and 1840. And he actually wrote to the British, telling them that he launched these uprisings because of the oppressive nature of the Persian government. Now, whatever his actual motivations were, the Aga Khan was branded a political rebel by the Qajar court. And so, and then again, it's not so clear how this happened, but he basically joined the British forces, and starting in Kandahar, he worked for them, and he was basically paid to provide strategic and military support. And then after Kandahar, after the British were forced to evacuate Afghanistan in 1842, he arrived to Sindh, where he helped with its annexation. He helped Charles Napier. Then he helped the British in controlling neighboring Balochistan. So you see, he was working for them in these different places. And then by 1848, his official appointment ended, but he remained in India and settled in Bombay. So that's the story of how he came to India. So that's one piece of it. And on the other side, you have the Khojas. And the Khojas were a caste. That is, they were a particular social grouping based on ties of endogamy, occupation, language, and religious practices. And in the 19th century, there were really just a few hundred families in the early 19th century. But by 1866, and this is the date of the big court case, the number had grown to about 1400. And Khojas were not native to Bombay. They had been, for the most part, petty farmers and agriculturalists in places like Sindh, Gujarat, and Kutch before they moved to Bombay to pursue trade. And over the course of the 19th century, they moved to Bombay, where they really flourished economically as a community in the sphere of commerce. And the leaders of the Khoja caste, they were known as the Kshatriyas. They were traders by profession, and they were the wealthiest of the Khojas, and they exerted much influence over Bombay, right? And they had their own congregation, which was called the Jamaat, which actually comes to mean the congregation of adult males that governed the community. And this Jamaat, these meetings would take place at the Jamaat Khana, which is kind of a council hall in which the Jamaat met and made the community's decisions. So the Kshatriyas were the powerful leaders of the Khojas, and they were the directors. They were in charge of the Jamaats. So they were a very influential community in Bombay. But they also had a lot of ties with the other communities, like Parsis and Hindu and Jain Bunyas and Boras. These merchant groups really controlled most of the wealth of Bombay city. Now, the Khoja Jamaat, they were... This community was governed independently, right? The colonial government did not really interfere in Khoja affairs. All disputes, et cetera, were taken, mediated within the community. And, you know, whether it was like husband and wife disputes, any marriage, like, you know, marriage, if any marriage was to take place, it had to be consulted with, you know, within the community, within the Jamaat. And so all of these issues, all the sort of inheritance, succession, all these issues were determined by the Jamaat, the Khoja leaders. Mm-hmm. Now, how did these two groups come into contact with each other, the Aga Khan and the Khoja leaders? Well, throughout the early and into the mid-19th century, the Aga Khan amassed a pretty good, a lot of support from the Khoja community. And the reason why he had done this is that because his father was actually an object of, he was also a political leader in the Qajar court, but he was also considered an imam and an object of devotion. And apparently there had been Khojas who had visited him and paid tributes in the past. Now the details of this relationship really remain obscure, but it was apparent that the Aga Khan, this Aga Khan who came to India, he claimed to succeed his father's role as an object of reverence. And although the Aga Khan was obviously traveling in all of these different places, he wrote letters to this community in Bombay and sent emissaries to the Khoja community. And through these chains of communications, managed to convince a lot of Khojas that both he and his lineage occupied a position in their community's history. Right. So he actually was successful in introducing new religious practices, many of which the Khojas were not familiar with. He required tributes, which many Khojas resented. And he actually initiated changes in the customs of inheritance, which was actually unsuccessful. And that was the first court case that happened. It was in 1847. And I don't talk about it as much because the decision in 1847, when there was this conflict between the Khoja leaders and the Aga Khan, the British court, the colonial court basically said, you know, you people just figure it out yourselves. Let's keep the custom of inheritance as is. Now, in 1866, something different happened. Now, the Khoja caste leaders, they opposed his role in the community. So what they did, they filed a suit and they claimed that the Aga Khan was this dispute was a property dispute.
Right.
And they told him, they basically filed a suit saying he needs to be extricated from all caste affairs. And so that's what that property dispute and this claim for authority over the community is what instigated the terms of the Aga Khan case.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for that very detailed rendition of the Aga Khan case. So the interesting thing that I found really fascinating in reading about the Aga Khan case is that here you have a dispute or a case which is primarily about property, and this property dispute turns into one about religious identity, where you have the colonial state having to decide about the religious identity and the boundaries of that identity of a community. So could you perhaps talk a little about how a case about property dispute turns into one about religious identity?
Sure. It's really one of the most fascinating pieces of the trial, actually. So as you're right, and this is the sort of the strange shift that happened in the trial, because the case of 1866 was officially a property dispute. However, in the course of the trial, the presiding judge, Justice Arnold, he found it necessary to determine the religious identity of the Khojas before he resolved the issue of property ownership. And, you know, this trial went on. When I read the accounts of the trial, it's amazing to see, like, to what extent the judge was so fixated on this question of religious identity. But it wasn't just the judge, right? It was the framing of religion by the plaintiffs that started all this business about religion. So in order to undermine the Aga Khan's authority and role in the community, the caste leaders filed a case claiming that the property of the Khojas belonged to only members of the Khoja caste. And since the Aga Khan was not a Khoja, he had no right to intervene in caste and property issues. So the disagreements between the two sides centered specifically on control of caste affairs, property ownership, and payment of revenues. But despite this, both the plaintiffs and the defense were required to make a case about the religious identity of the Khojas. Justice Arnold was determined to figure out what their religious identity was first, right? And ultimately, he sided on the side of the defense, which officially proclaimed that the Khojas and the Aga Khan were Shi'i Ismaili. As part of that decision, he concluded that the property of the Khoja caste belonged to the Aga Khan. Now, of course, crucial for my study were two questions. How was this religious identity of the Khojas established as Ismaili? And second, why was it necessary to establish the religious identity in a property dispute? Well, Arnold officially, the interesting part here is that Arnold officially declared the religious identity of the Khojas in the final judgment as Ismaili Muslim through an interpretation of poetry. So one of the key documents through which the defense argued their case for the Khoja identity as Ismaili was the text Dasavatar. Now, Dasavatar is literally means the 10 avatars. It's the poem of the Ginan genre that I talked about earlier. It's a Gujarati Hindi vernacular rendering of the classic Sanskrit story of the 10 avatars of Vishnu. And this poem, this text was transmitted and finally transcribed in the early 18th century. It was, you know, it was passed down orally for a long time. Now, it was a central document in the trial because both the plaintiffs and the defense described it as the single most important religious text of the Khojas. The defense, however, this is the side of the Aga Khan, schematized the Savitar in such a way to show that the Khojas were specifically Ismaili Muslims. So you must remember, both sides agree that this is the most important text, but it's about who did the most creative or convincing argument, you know, with it or interpreted it most convincingly.
Right.
And the
right.
defense, they pointed to the fact that they made the argument that, look, you have the first 9 chapters, which narrate stories of Hindu avatars, but the final chapter distinctly focuses on Ali, the first Shi'i imam. And this transition, they argued, proved that the Khojas were Hindu converts to Ismaili Islam. And so this reading was, the other side, the plaintiffs could not come, they could not counter this argument. So Justice Arnold went with the defense's reading of Dasavatar, and decided, look, the Khojas were converts to Ismaili Islam. He arrived at this conclusion that this theological and the division in the text demonstrated the history of Khojas as Hindu converts to Ismaili Islam. So this is pretty wild, because really at one stroke he really redefined the Khojas as converts, and Dasavatar is a conversion text. And so what I illustrate is how the judge's interpretation of Dasavatar divided the poem into two parts, one Hindu, one Muslim, and this reading was utterly novel. Right. And because it demarcated these categories and created a Muslim identity for the Khojas. And again, the work of it, the arguments was laid out in the trial. But what Justice Arnold did, he put it together in a narrative in the judgment.
So that's very, very fascinating. One of the major points that you make in this book is that this case, the Aga Khan case of 1866, radically altered the way in which Ismaili identity was henceforth imagined. And this intervention of the colonial state in deciding over what that identity should be and what the boundaries of that identity should be really has henceforth altered the way in which Ismailis imagined their identity. So perhaps if I could have you say a bit more about the implications of this case and ways in which this case altered the parameters and the horizons of Ismaili religious identity in the years after this case until today in many ways. What are some of the ways in which Ismaili identity was altered and transformed as a result of this case?
Yeah, well, I make the argument that, you know, the 1866 decision that Khojas were Ismaili Muslim, or Muslim, let's say, in this identitarian is the term that I use, sense, this has had lasting repercussions for the self-identification of the Ismaili community. In the early 20th century, the third Aga Khan, Sultan Muhammad Shah, whom, if we get a chance, I guess maybe we'll talk about a little bit later in the interview, he mandated a series of Islamicized reforms within the community, What I talk about the most in the book is the production of an official canon of the Genans in print. And this canon was marked by a series of changes, which were such as the discarding of Hindu, all kinds of quote Hindu names like Hari and Krishna, and the introduction of new Islamic ones. So that was one really important phase or change that took place with regard to the Genans. And today, I'll give you just an example.
Sure.
The current Aga Khan, Prince Karim Aga Khan IV, he has further Islamicized the Ismaili liturgical setting, changing the language of service from the vernacular Gujarati to Arabic, mandating greater use of the Quran, and most recently, as of the 70s, I believe, banning all, quote, Hinduistic Genans, including Dasavatar, right? The Genan that was agreed to be the single most important text in the
right.
course of the trial, right?
Right.
Or important Genan. So banning it altogether. So that's one piece of it. And again, we can talk about it a little bit more if we get a chance to talk about Sultan Muhammad Shah. But
sure.
what I'm very interested in and what's really informed a lot of my own work has been thinking about the ways in which this 1866 case has come to set the terms of scholarly discussions mm-hmm. about the Genans. Mm-hmm. So scholars who work on the Genans, for the most part, accept the interpretation of the poems as Ismaili conversion texts, mm-hmm. which from my perspective is really affirming the judge's 1866 outcome and judgment. So for example, the sort of famous, the well-known Ismaili studies historian Farhad Daftari will make a very extensive argument about the Genans and what they are. He will explain, he has described the Genans as conversion texts used by the Nizari Dawa in India, right? Note this kind of use of language. So basically taking the Persian history of Ismailism and putting it onto the Indian context, he will say that what the Genans are basically the peers of the Nizari Dawa, their attempts to convert low classes, the lower classes, to Ismaili Islam, right? Using Hindu motifs, accommodating indigenous religious mores and concepts that basically won the masses of converts. So what he does is he assumes two points about the Genan tradition. First, that its origin was Nizari, that is Persian, and that in the context of India, the peers of the Ismaili mission attracted converts by spreading their message through the language of a, quote, Hindu ambience. You know, is that the word that he uses? And so from this perspective, the Genans represent an encounter, from his point of view, an encounter between two separate religious traditions, Hindu and Ismaili. And what I see is that this interpretation divides the Genans into two parts and really gives primacy to that conversion argument. It basically replicates without question the exact logic of the legal ruling of the Aga Khan case, right? So I would say that even the most sophisticated works in Ismaili studies scholarship treat Hindu elements in the poems as simply facilitating conversion. And so this is really this tradition of scholarship has really defined the frames in which the Genans are understood. And that prevailing assumption that Genans represent an extension and continuation of Persian Ismailism. And I'm not saying that this is willful or anything like that, or active
sure,
occlusion.
Sure.
It's just, I like to point to the ways in which these arguments about conversion have been shaped and how they really have enduring force. And they preserve this Persian pedigree, basically. And what I also see is that they really alienate the Indic context, right? And it's what I try to do in my readings is I try to argue that the Indic ideas in the Genans are not just part of an ambience, but they really are the primary conduits of what I'll describe a little bit later as the Satpant tradition of Islam, which is very different than what's been described as the Ismaili tradition of Islam, and that this vernacular that's used is not really a strategy of conversion, but it's really the linguistic medium of this local vernacular Islamic religious form of Islamic religious expression.
Excellent. So Satpant being the true path, right? Could you just say a couple
right.
of words?
Right. It's the Satpant being the true path, and really the word that's used mm-hmm. to describe the path of Islam in these texts, right? It's
right.
not Ismaili is
right.
not the word. Satpant is the word. And I really work with this idea to try to figure out what the Ginans are all about.
Excellent. The things which is really fascinating about this book is that not only do you walk readers through rich textual and historical archives and provide a very multi-layered analysis throughout your book, but you also talk extensively about larger conceptual questions about the study of Islam and religion and South Asia. And so this, you write about the politics of the scholarship in addition to this very multi-layered analysis that you provide of your historical and textual sources. And one of the key arguments which I found very interesting that you make is that you are critical of two categories, one being the category of sect and the other being the category of syncretism in the study of Islam and South Asian religions. What do you find particularly problematic in these categories, sect and syncretism in the study of religion, and in what way do you find them replicating modern colonial conceptions of religion in the contemporary study of Islam? If I could have you say a bit about that.
Okay, maybe I'll start with sect, and I'll just draw from the book to explain
sure.
my position.
Sure.
So in the judgment, in the Aga Khan case judgment, the distinction between church and sect, I argue, provided the paradigm through which Justice Arnold decided the came to the conclusion and decided the religious identity of the Khojas. So in the classical Western division between church and sect, you have church, which represents a corporate center, and then sects, that which are groups that break off from that center while retaining certain elements fundamental to the doctrines of the church, right? So this is kind of the Weberian idea of church and sect. And my reading of what Arnold thought about church and sect was really along these lines. He identified the Khojas as a Muslim sect. Mm-hmm. And of course, classifying the Khojas as a sect assumes that there is an equivalent church in Islam. And according in the judgment, Arnold makes the point that Sunni Islam was the church and Ismaili Islam was a sect, was a sect of the Shia. So what I argue is that, in fact, by mapping the Khojas as a sect, as Ismaili and locating them as a sect, the Khojas were inserted into a classificatory scheme, right? Placed into an already systemized idea of Islam in which, let's say, the Arab or the Sunni world was its center, and then internal differences within the tradition were defined through this template of church and sect. And the other important point here is that, and this goes back to my point about identity and what I call identitarianism, just as Arnold's conception of religion was identitarian. And what I mean by that is that he alleged that the Khojas must have a religious identity, right? They must have a religious identity, and that they must have a single religious identity. There was no either or both possible here. And so the Khojas could only be Hindu or Muslim. This is what was one of the questions at the beginning of the trial. Mm-hmm. And if they were Muslim, they must be Sunni or Shi'i. So in this way, this scheme he provided had these constraints, right, in terms of the way Khojas were placed. And so, of course, I try to do something different and explain, you know, through their religious practices and Ginans, look, that we need to think about that it's very inaccurate to use this term sect to think about the Khojas. But actually, to go back to your question about the study of Islam, I think that is really, it's really important because this term has been so completely naturalized, right? And I really, I tell my students this in all of my, you know, intro courses and even my Sufism course, that this term sect is really misleading. And it is inaccurate because within Islam, we have there is no equivalent of church, right? There's no corporate institution. And so what we do by using this term, we perpetuate the ways in which we elide these differences, I think, between, say, Christianity and Islam. Or, and I give you another example, is with Sufism, right? It's so hard to break out of the idea, that received idea that Sufism is a mystical sect of Islam, right? But if we participate in this logic, we continue to reify and naturalize this dichotomy, these divisions, which really aren't there, right? If those of us who understand or are sympathetic or want to think about Islam and history and practices, I mean, if we think about the idea of tasawwuf instead, we're forced to think about a process, right? If we use that term tasawwuf, we're like, okay, a process, a tradition that has always been part and parcel of Islam, not some sect, some break, right? And so I have a real problem using this term sect within the study of Islam, and I think that the Ismaili case reveals that problem really quite dramatically.
So Tina, let me return to the Das Avatar, because it is so crucial to the story of this book. And you critique the way, or show the ambiguities and the contradictions of the way in which British colonial authorities approached this text and read this text in a very identitarian fashion in order to ascribe this very fixed religious identity onto a community, the Ismaili Khojas. But you don't stop there. You provide an alternative reading. You also go one step further and make the argument that these texts can be read in very different ways and can be read against what you call the modern judicial archive. And that I found a very fast hermeneutical exercise that you conducted in this book about reading these kinds of texts, the Das Avatar specifically, in a way which would counter the modern judicial archive or the British colonial manner of reading this or approaching this text. Could you tell us a little more about how you go about presenting and fashioning this alternative reading of the Das Avatar?
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the points of entrance where I try to figure out what is going on with this text and what is so central to this text and why what the court has said doesn't do justice to it, or why the conversion argument doesn't do justice to it. Where I enter my own analysis is Das Avatar's discussion of temporality and messianism. And I argue that it's really within these two ideas that we see the very complex workings of what I call Satpant Islam, right? So the form of Islam articulated by the Ginans. This can be seen in Das Avatar's approach to and discussion of messianism and temporality. So I'll tell you a little bit about the poem. The poem is premised on the belief on the messianic worldview. And what I mean by that, I draw really, I use the work of Abdullah Aziz Sajjadina to describe what I'm talking about in terms of imamate messianism, which is this perspective where the present world on the one hand and life beyond is given meaning and reconciled through the imamate idea that an expected deliverer is supposed to come and humble or destroy the forces of wickedness and establish rule on earth, right? And this is his formulation, Sajjadina. So, and I see this at play in Das Avatar, where what you have is a story of good and evil. And the culminating event in Das Avatar is this confrontation between good and evil armies that happens. And the protagonist of the story is the 10th avatar. And this figure moves between a Mahdi figure as well as a Vaishnava figure, right? He's described as arriving on a white horse with a sword, so very much along the lines of, you know, the way Ali Imam is envisioned, but also the final avatar in the cycle of Hindu avatars. And this figure, who's often referred to as the Shah, he comes out of hiding, very much in accordance with Shi'i Mahdi theology, which rests on the idea of an appearance, right? And he moves out of occultation, and this confrontation between two armies, good and evil, it actually takes place between two spaces, in what's called an Arab Desh, which is supposedly Arab lands, and then in India. And at the start of the poem, this Shah, this 10th avatar, resides in the Arab Desh, but he actually confronts the demon's army and the great social transformation that happens, takes place in India. So there's a lot of anticipation, and there's this whole description, really beautiful description of the physical and social overturning of order. And Shah himself, right, he's getting ready to establish his throne, and the detailed descriptions of his horse and his physical form. It's all about anticipation. And so, and then ultimately the Shah destroys the demon and that slays the entire army, and so that's the end. Mm-hmm. But one of the points I describe it in the book is that what's so significant about the account of this is that the closing verses of Dasavatar describe at length what's called the eternal abode, the Amrapuri, mm-hmm. that's promised for all the believers. And ultimately the poem closes by stating that those who follow the words of Dasavatar will be spared from the cycle of reincarnation, samsara, and they will also avoid the fire of the great day, the Mahadin. And now I make the point here that what is so significant is that we have two ideas of the afterlife, very much a cyclical idea of death and rebirth, which is very Indic. And it's also explained along the line of karma very extensively in Dasavatar. But then you also have this final judgment day, right? And so you have this, what I call, and I know arguments can be made that, Quranic ideas of time are not really linear, but they are linear compared to the cyclical idea of time and, of samsara. But so what I point to is that temporality here really is cyclical and linear, and that the simultaneity of Mahadin and samsara, it cannot be made equivalent through, say, a syncretistic approach or even a sectarian understanding of these texts. There's no idea that's given primacy here. We can't say one is more important than the other. And there's really no single definition or process of commensuration that can account for both cyclical and linear ideas of temporality. So what I try to show is that really that these events in the poem allowed me to make my point that the locality of Islam, the indigenousness of Islam, they can really be read through an engagement with the messianic imaginary of Ismaili religiosity, right? One that was squarely Muslim and squarely Indic. And so it's obvious that concepts of temporality in Dasavatar cannot be relegated to Justice Arnold's idea of sect, which is premised on the logic of conversion, right? And really hammering the point that Arnold's definition of text of sect effectively situated Dasavatar as an expression of Persian Islam, and it made Dasavatar comprehensible within something that didn't do justice to its own context and milieu, is what I would say.
Terrific. Turn to a theme that you've touched on a bit earlier, but I want to return to it concerning Sultan Muhammad Shah Agha Khan III. You mentioned how this modern Muslim political and figure and imam of the Ismaili community in the 20th century, that he went about cleansing Ismaili identity of its Hindu past and the traces of Hindu thought and practice in Ismaili traditions. So could you tell us a bit more about how he went about this process of, and what were some of the ambiguities or contradictions attached to this operation of trying to purify or cleanse Ismaili identity from its Hindu past?
Sure. I mentioned it just briefly earlier when we were talking about the legacy of this court case and the changes that were made.
Right.
And I discussed kind of at length this particular point that one of the major initiations of Sultan Muhammad Shah was the initiatives he mandated, let's say, in the direction of canon formation, which was really the first time undertaken within the Ismaili community itself. The Ginans were first collected, right? For the purpose of producing this canon, And it was Aga Khan III or Sultan Muhammad Shah that really, it actually started, the imamate of the second Aga Khan was very short. So really the major, he, Aga Khan II, but this third one really, Sultan Muhammad Shah really furthered this process of canon formation. He had this famous publisher he appointed, Lalji Devraj. And Devraj's initiatives included an exhaustive search and compilation of Ginnan manuscripts, and the establishment of the Khoja Sindhi Press, the first community press. And again, repeating what I said earlier, and a lot of these changes, that, the changes that were made were the discarding of a lot of Hindu names and the assertion of Islamic ones. So the canon formation was the one space where this this cleansing or purging that you're, that the word that you used started. The other would be, I would say, the Farmans, which I think were very much the statements to the community. The Farmans were this, were the genre, let's say, through which Sultan Muhammad Shah delineated the new terms of Ismaili belief and practice when he became imam. And so he told, you know, so he told the community what to, what sort of things to do. There's this famous one of the statements that he said, that from one of his farmans, is that it's not proper to read Hindu things in your ilm. When you were Hindus at that time, Pir Sadruddin showed you the way. That time is gone. Now recite the praise of Mullah Ali and his progeny, the imams of the time. Give up the nine avatars. Recite the praise of our forefathers and us of Mullah Avatar. So he's, you know, give up the nine avatars, right? That's the kind of point there. Mm-hmm. And that point of giving up the nine avatars, discarding the Hindu, that also manifested itself in the changes in the dua, in the Ismaili canonical prayer, which in many ways parallels what was, what he did in, with the Ginans and the Farmans. And there, you know, I guess it's really the 1930s and 1940s where a lot of these changes took place. I guess prior to the 1930s, the dua addressed the 10 avatars. And later after that, the avatars were replaced by lists of Ismaili imams. So we see this, the same sort of move. So that's the kind of ritual and liturgical changes along those lines. But he did other things which were very important in terms of the shaping of the community. He reorganized the structure of the Khoja community, replacing all of those traditional caste positions, right? The way I explained that the Khoja, it was a very involved like caste structure in the Jamaat that was organized around these particular leaders, and he completely shifted all of that, and he replaced the older structures of the Khoja community caste leadership with what were called Ismaili councils, and these councils derived their authority solely from appointment by the Aga Khan. And he actually drafted a Shi'i Imami Ismaili constitution in which all members of the Khoja Jamaat were obliged to abide by, in which the community issues were resolved. So the constitution was actually, and this is very interesting, it was actually a response to those who decided to break from the community. And he has several statements about this too, about the Farman, in his Farmans, about these quote, seceders, these groups who broke. And so it was really to sharpen and kind of make tight the community identity, because it was clearly in flux. There's some really interesting work coming out on the Khoja Ithnashri community and how they had to redefine themselves, because prior to Sultan Muhammad Shah's imamate, they were all one. I mean, everybody was sharing the same practices and things like that, but with the split, they had to make a decision on whether they were going to join the Ismaili Khojas or create their own groups. And so even within the Khoja community, so many splits arose as a consequence of this, these changes.
Now, staying with Sultan Muhammad Shah for a bit, one of the things that you really brilliantly show in your book is a sort of paradox or a tension that you see in the figure of Sultan Muhammad Shah, and specifically between his public persona as a Muslim political leader in the 20th century, who was a Muslim modernist par excellence in ways in which he was critical of traditional forms of education, of mysticism, and really tried to push for this very modern, secular Muslim subjectivity. But on the other hand, when it came to his role as the imam or the leader of his community, he nonetheless went about deifying his own persona and created a very hierarchical system of patronage within the Ismaili community. And there you have, even in the way in which he approached certain Ismaili writings, a very enchanted vision of his own position, of his own position within the Ismaili community, while he's pushing for a more disenchanted public sphere and so forth. And that I found to be a very fascinating tension or paradox that you describe very brilliantly. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about this contradiction or tension between the public and communal persona or role that Sultan Muhammad Shah played in the 20th century. And what did you find in terms of this contradiction or tension?
Yeah. What's so interesting is that Sultan Muhammad Shah basically assumed two distinct positions. First, as you said, as a modernist reformer in the public sphere and a Muslim political leader, representing a kind of position of pan-Muslim unity. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was doing all these things I described earlier within the Ismaili community, really enforcing his position as sectarian leader. So that's kind of... that's sort of interesting just to begin with. But let me just talk a little bit about what he did. His role was really important, actually. He was a reformer, and he really spoke, in support of Western education, importance for Muslims to participate in political life. And in many ways, he followed in the footsteps of people like Syed Ahmad Khan, who campaigned against, what was called, quote, Muslim backwardness. He really was within that reformist tradition, but he also had an interesting role, because he took his efforts, political efforts in the direction of separatist politics, and he played a really integral role in pushing for the installation of separate electorates for Muslims, and he was actually the president of the first All India Muslim League. So that was one kind of role. And the way I sort of described it in the book is this sort of, you describe it as enchanted and disenchanted. I think that's kind of interesting. And the way I think of it is much more simply as horizontal and vertical. And what I mean by that is that this sort of pan-Muslim unity is about putting everybody as equal, bringing all Muslims together.
Right.
And then this vertical, what I describe as vertical, has to do a little bit more with what you're calling the enchanted, right? As sort of retaining his position as imam and his status as divine leader within the what I call the private domain. He was essentially the Ismaili messianic sovereign, right? And so in the final chapter of the book, I explain the kinds of, these changes that took place within the sphere of Ismaili religious practice. But really the most significant being that he actually was able to. So, for example, one of the readings I do of these canonized hymns is of a poem called Enthronement Hymn, and that actually it's a hymn that's recited, in praise of the Aga Khan's whoever the current Aga Khan is. But in the Enthronement Hymn, what you see very clearly is that Muhammad Shah is actually. So this idea of messianism that I was talking about earlier with Dasavatar, the Ginam tradition was very much built on this idea of messianic expectation, right? Waiting for the imam. And so Enthronement Hymn really places Sultan Muhammad Shah as the fulfillment of messianic expectation, right? Mm-hmm. And so you see these new terms of Ismaili devotion that are brought into line with this idea of Muhammad with Muhammad Shah as the primary object of devotion. And so this kind of reconfiguring that takes place is quite interesting, because it works on these older ideas of messianic time, the awaiting, right, the expectation, all of this. But in the poems themselves, especially this poem in particular, you see that there's this sense that now we have a new idea of community, right, that's not based on expectation, but now a sense of fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. That's very fascinating. Let me take a step back from the specifics of the project and ask you about the larger positioning or the larger conceptual stakes of this project. And let me ask you about this long-running debate or argument or conversation in the field of South Asian studies and also in religious studies more broadly, what we might call the continuity versus rupture debate about the role of colonial modernity and colonialism in the formation of religious identities, whether from pre-modern to colonial India, we find a rupture or a continuity of identities and so forth. And this has been a conversation which has been going on for some time. So how do you see your book making a contribution to this debate? And if I could put you a bit on the spot, where do you stand? What are your thoughts on this on this ongoing conversation and debate in South Asian studies and religious studies, more broadly speaking?
Yeah, it's a very big debate in South Asian studies for sure. And I've worked on pre-modern literature so much, and I've been part of those conversations, and yet I have been also inducted into, you know, modern South Asian history in those debates. I feel very sympathetic to, you know, both kinds of worlds and sets of debates. And I say both because they seem to be pretty separate at times. And I would say, I mean, I come down pretty clearly on the rupture, I guess, because I think we see, you know, it's really hard to make a debate about continuity having read my book. But I think what the book does is, unlike a kind of, let's say, to be reductive, an invention of tradition argument, my point is not that a tradition is invented, but it's reconfigured, right, in new ways. What is invented, what it really is new, or what it, in this case of Ismaili identity, is really the legal and political aspect, the legal identity, right? And this is the point I'm not sure if I fully emphasized at the beginning, which is that Ismaili was a label, right? It was a legal label designated in the court. And so that is very unique. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that that identity was created in this particular moment, right? Mm-hmm. But if we step back and think about just general shifts and changes and ruptures, I think we see very clearly that the crisis was instigated because of the colonial state in the 19th century. And, you know, but yet it wasn't just that. It wasn't just the colonial state. So it's not just about, you know, the colonial invention of tradition. It's about what was happening within the community and the very complicated dynamics, you know, intra-community dynamics. And I think that's why I would shift the focus to not so much putting so much on, you know, whether colonialism changed everything, but really, like, look what the sort of changes that were instigated by in the 19th century within communities too. Right? I hope that answers your question.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fascinating discussion in many ways. So continuing with that, if I could perhaps connect your own positionality as someone. In some ways, it's quite rare that you're able to straddle these different fields of South Asian religions, Islamic studies, and do so very adeptly. If I could perhaps connect your own positionality as situated at the boundaries of Islamic studies and South Asian studies with the argument, the larger argument, which is trying to make us think differently about the boundaries of religious identity, of the rupture that you've see in the hardening of religious identities when you have Ismaili Khojas being demarcated as either Hindu or Muslim and so forth. This logic of identity, this modern logic of identity in which you're either or. In what ways, this is sort of an open-ended question, in what ways do you see your own intellectual positioning at the boundaries of these different fields being mapped on to the larger project and the larger argument that you make about making us think differently about these boundaries, and how, in what ways do you see your own straddling between different fields being reflected in the kind of argument that you're making and the political stakes of your project about making us think differently about modern identities and their boundaries and limits and so forth?
You know, it's, I guess I haven't thought about that one too much, but I think that I can say that I'm hired. It's interesting. I teach in Islamic studies and I teach in South Asian studies, and I always feel like, you know, there, especially with Islamic studies, there is a sort of a notion of a center in some ways, and I think that has to do a little bit with you know the legacy of Orientalism and how the study of Islam has come to the West. And so I think this sort of questioning, what I realized really is this questioning that that came about during the court case, and how the Ismailis were identified as Khojas, as part of Persian Islam. It really revealed that kind of bias, this kind of Arab centrism. And this is what the blurb of my book, for example, is saying, right? Or the description of my book. It's about trying to get away from an Arab centric Islam. This is the way this community was constituted through the court. And this is also what I see myself doing. And by virtue of the fact that I have come to Islam via South Asia, I feel like I'm also doing that work myself, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think those two things are happening at the same time, that we see the bias, we see the legacy of this bias in the way we understand and we approach Islam, but I also am forced to constantly be doing the work to undo that, because that's the perspective I come to. Had I been trained in, you know, fiqh or in Arabic and Persian, I'm not sure if I would have the same lens that I bring to this case and to this project here. So I think it's very much shaped by my own intellectual the argument of the book is very much shaped by my own intellectual trajectory.
Right. So Tina, as we're approaching, as we're running out of time, thank you so much for the generosity of your time. Perhaps we can complete this conversation about the projects that you're working on these days. What occupies you these days in terms of the work that you're doing? And what are some of the things that we can expect to read from you in the future? So generally, could you tell us about the projects that you're working on right now?
Sure. I have a couple different projects that are hopefully will kind of come together as one big project. One of them is, both of them tie in some ways, developed from this 19th century study of the Ismailis. And one has to do with the question of heresy in modern Islam, and how we understand this problem of who's inside and who's outside, right? And I think the Ismailis are really one case, which is not as charged as, say, some other communities like the Ahmadiyya. The Ahmadis, which is one group that I'm working on right now, especially I'm interested in reading the writings of Ghulam Ahmad, and especially how he has been declared by many in the time, not so much the time that he was writing, but a little bit later, and certainly in the modern period, as heretics, as heterodox, part of a heterodox Islam. So I'm interested in thinking about that particular community in relation to the question of heresy. But the larger project I'm thinking about is on modernism, Islamic modernism, and Islamic modernist thinking. And I'm struck so much by, I'm teaching class on modern Islam, how modernists, especially, there are always these standard, you know, classical modernists, such as, you know, Muhammad Abdu and Rashid Rida and Sayyid Ahmed Khan and Muhammad Iqbal. And so we have these standard modernists, but we never think about, say, Sultan Muhammad Shah, who's such an important figure during this period, or Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, also a modernist, right? And so I'm thinking about, why are leaders of these, quote, sectarian communities not in the modernist conversations? And so I'm thinking about writing about how modern Islamic modernism is a potentially expansive idea that has been somewhat flattened out and read in terms of these classical modernists, and they're what I call versions of a, quote, Protestant Islam, whereas within their own texts and within their own writings, there's a lot of interesting material that I think hasn't been discussed on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have other figures, other modernists who are in the same period that don't seem to make it into the conversation. And I want to bring them into this larger modernist conversation and think about the movement in new ways, hopefully.
Wonderful. So the Aga Khan case, Religion and Identity in Colonial India, by Tina Purohit, published by Harvard University Press in 2012. Thank you so much, Tina, for your time. It was an absolute pleasure reading your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And I'm sure our listeners also appreciate this conversation and your very articulate and erudite answers to some of the questions posed to you. So thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to reading more of your work in the future.
Thank you so much, Sher Ali, for these fabulous questions and this opportunity with New Books in Islamic Studies.
So this was my conversation with Professor Tina Purohit of Boston University about her recent book, The Aga Khan Case, Religion and Identity in Colonial India, published by Harvard University Press in 2012. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please join us next time also for another conversation in New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, thank you, goodbye, and stay well.